KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this morning's opening forum, our famed historian, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Gary Wills will be joining us for a wide-ranging conversation about What Jesus Meant, the title of his newest book, and an in-depth exploration of the life of Jesus, a life and portrait that will surprise, maybe even shock you. Forum is next with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. In this first hour, we're going to talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and author Gary Wills, who is professor of history emeritus at Northwestern and the author of many acclaimed books on religion, including Papal Sin and Why I Am a Catholic. He won the Pulitzer Prize for Lincoln at Gettysburg. He joins us for this morning's opening hour to discuss his newest book, A Controversial Portrait of Jesus Drawn from the Scripture, titled What Jesus Meant. And we welcome you, Gary Wills. Glad to have you back here.
Thank you.
Well, this is a portrait of Jesus that I think is going to surprise a lot of people. You describe your book as not a scholarly book, but a devotional one, and yet we get a picture of someone who, the Son of Man, that is, displaced, fugitive, subversive, at least according to the Gospels, really a scandalous figure.
Well, yes, over and over we're told that he was rejected, that he was attacked. They tried to stone him. They tried to throw him off a cliff. Herod tried to assassinate him. His own family turned on him. He was on the run. He hid from his own followers at times. He avoided the cities because they were dangerous. When Lazarus died and the sisters of Lazarus called him to go back, the disciples said, "You can't go back. They're trying to kill you there." So he was an outcast all of his life, homeless. He said, "Foxes have lairs and birds have places to nest, but I have nowhere to lay my head."
Not only an outcast, but someone who preferred, as you point out, the company of the lowly and the depressed, almost like an outlaw and an outcast among outcasts. In fact, not only a homeless portrait we get here of someone, but really a working class and a subversive character as well.
That's right. You'll notice that in his followers in the gospel are no doctors of the law, no Pharisees, no priests, no Sadducees, just ordinary fishermen and despised tax collectors and people of that sort. He was not somebody who was part of the establishment at all, the religious establishment of Judea. And in fact, he defied it. He brought on himself the charge that he was blasphemous, that he was unclean, that he broke all of the taboos. Every kind of uncleanness, ritual uncleanness of his time, he broke through. He talked to the people you're not supposed to talk to, prostitutes and lepers and women who were Samaritans or women who were menstruating, all of the things that would contaminate you in terms of ritual law. And over again, he said that the external ritual does not matter. It's not what you take into your mouth that makes you unclean, but what comes out of your mouth. He was entirely concentrated on the interior life and the interior worship. He said, for instance, when you pray, do not pray in public, as the hypocrites do. They get their reward from the acclaim that they get. When you pray, go into your inner chamber and lock the door and pray in hiding to your Father. And your Father who sees you in hiding will give you what you need. So people who want us now to have public prayer and that kind of thing go exactly against what Jesus said in the Gospel of Matthew.
Well, you also make a case for those who want hierarchy and hierarchy in the church, or those who try to perhaps conceal this more subversive side and more radical side of Jesus as really not being in sync with what is in the Gospels.
That's right. He defied the temple and sacrifice and the priesthood. Over and over, he said that these are not the things that you should pay attention to. You should only pay attention to the interior life that I am opening up for you. Communion with him is the way to the Father, is what he said. He is the temple from now on. And so he would do things that no other observant Jew would do. For instance, as I say, menstruating women were unclean, and everything they touched was unclean for a long time. And if they were permanently menstruating, they were permanently unclean and could not go into the temple or prepare people's food or wash their clothes or anything of that sort. And here was a woman who was unclean and came to him and touched him, making him unclean, of course. And the disciples were shocked. And he said, it doesn't matter. Her faith saved her. That's what matters.
Talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Gary Wills, his new book is called What Jesus Meant. He's also the author of Why I Am a Catholic. There are passages in both the Synoptic and non-Synoptic Gospels that certainly give one pause. The whole passage about Jesus kicking the fig tree comes to my mind. You write about the famous passage, "Think not I come imposing peace to earth. I come bringing not peace but a sword. I bring conflict between a man and his father, a daughter and her mother, a wife and her mother-in-law." All of that pretty much giving us again a picture of someone who was, a blank disturber. I'm using the S word here advisedly.
That's right. The settled life, the conventional life, the kind of mores of the what we would call the middle class, he said, is deceptive. It's not the real way to the Father. And if you really want to go to the Father, you may have to defy all of the conventions of your time, as he did. After all, he ran away from his family when he was 12.
Forgive me, but a lot of people don't even know that Jesus had brothers and sisters.
That's right. He had four, according to the Gospels, and they were against him. They're the ones who tried to throw him off a cliff. And when his family came to him, including his mother, and asked to see him, he said, I don't have a family. And he looked around to the people who were following him, and he said, the people who follow my word are my family.
The family considered him mad, at least his siblings did.
Some of them did, yes.
Yeah. And the whole notion of what would Jesus do, you say this is not a useful question for Christians to be asking.
Well, not for those who believe that he was divine, as I do. He did things that, of course, we can't do. We're not God, and we can't pretend to be God. And so when he casts devils out into pigs, destroying a great deal of property, we're not supposed to do that. And we're probably not supposed to drive people out of temples. He could do that because it was his father's house and he was able to take charge of it. No, he was not. The people who say what Jesus said are the people who believe in a kind of ethical teacher who is not divine, that he was just human like us, except more virtuous, and we should try to be more virtuous by imitating him. Well, we can't. We can't say, I can lay down my life and I can take it up again. We can't say, before Abraham was, I am. He's living on a much different plane from anything we know about. So his disciples, who were always trying to figure out what he was up to and almost never could, never asked themselves that they should do what Jesus was doing. They had enough trouble figuring out what he was doing.
Yet there's really a kind of polemic almost in your book about a radical egalitarianism in the Gospels, that the churches have resisted this, and it means that they resist Jesus.
That's right. He says there's only one test for getting into the reign of heaven. When it comes time to decide whether you're going to be able to enter into the Father's reign, only one question will be asked. Did you do this? He says to the people on his right hand, I was hungry and you fed me. I was thirsty and you gave me to drink. I was in prison and you visited me. I was naked and you clothed me. And because you did that, enter into the reign. And then he turns to the others and said, I was hungry and you did not feed me. I was naked and you did not clothe me. I was in prison and you did not come to me. So you may not enter the reign of heaven. That's the only test. What we do to the, and then he says, why? They say, we didn't know we were doing it to you. Where were you? He said, what you did to the least person on earth, you did to me. So just think about that. Every homeless person we despise, we're despising Jesus. Every boy a priest molests, he's molesting Jesus. Everybody who's tortured in Abu Ghraib, you're torturing Jesus. What you do to the least, to the outcast, like Jesus, you're doing to Jesus.
Well, you have said also that you don't see any political program in the Gospels, but this is a radical egalitarianism. It's non-hierarchical. The message is one of kind of radical total love. Isn't that political?
No, it's not at all political because it goes way beyond politics. No one can in politics say, if you're punched on one side of your face, turn the other side. You can't do that in politics. And Jesus didn't expect that. Politics has its own rules, which are justice. You have to try to give people justice. He goes way beyond, love goes far beyond justice. And every time people tried to involve him in politics, he refused. When he was standing before Pontius Pilate, Pilate said, "Are you a king?" And he said, "My reign is not of this order. If my reign were of this order, my followers would have fought for me. But they do not fight for me because my reign is not of this order." So if we try to make an earthly reign him, we are substituting a false Jesus for the real Jesus.
Speaking of substitution of a false Jesus, there is a picture that is almost ubiquitous of Jesus as a kind of sturdy, robust-looking, blonde, haloed character and so forth. And yet you, from what you're able to glean as a reader of the Gospels, give us a picture of someone who was probably frail and ascetic and weak, maybe particularly weak because he couldn't carry the cross.
That's right. You know, the conventional picture is of Simon of Cyrene helping him carry the cross. He couldn't carry the cross at all, the Gospel says. And at that time, it was only carrying the crossbeam. He was that weak, and he died so fast that Pilate was amazed that he had died so soon. We don't know what he looks like, of course, but the saintly people that I do know who are self-sacrificing and who are the kind of people that the underlings and outcasts have a kind of instant rapport with are people like St. Francis or the Baal Shem Tov or saints who are not athletes, not perfect specimens, as it were. And there's no reason to think that Jesus was that kind of robust Apollo Belvedere.
In fact, many of these charismatic figures are often pretty diminutive, as you point out.
That's right, especially the saintly ones. This is only a guess, of course, but he defied worldly standards. And if he met worldly standards of being a big, strapping, handsome, strong fellow, that would surprise me.
Talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Gary Wills, his new book is called What Jesus Meant, and we'll bring you into the conversation fairly soon. I just wanted to go over some other things that we get as a picture, not only of Jesus, but of those who tried to create a picture of Jesus. And you spent a lot of time talking about Thomas Jefferson's version of Jesus and the Jesus that came out of the Jesus seminars. And again, don't see these as actually being a fairly accurate representation.
Well, that's right. And they are the kind of people who would say, we have to do what Jesus did. In fact, that's what Thomas Jefferson did say. They could say that because they took the Gospels and removed from it everything that was not simply human virtue. They removed the prophecies, they removed the miracles, they removed the resurrection.
Wasn't Jefferson a deist?
Yes.
So he didn't believe in the resurrection, I presume.
No, he did not believe in the resurrection. A deist, of course, means a theist.
Right.
Deus is God. So he believed in God, he believed in providence, and he believed in an afterlife. But he did not believe that Jesus was divine. He did not believe in miracles. He did not believe in the resurrection. So what he gave us was an ethical, human, very admirable teacher. And that's good as far as it goes, but it doesn't go very far if you believe the really shocking and important things about Jesus.
And similarly with the Jesus Seminar that's tried to recover the historical Jesus.
Yes, they decide, well, this is what he really said. And they do it by saying, if it's something that we think outrageous, he couldn't have said it. So they instantly get rid of all the outrageous things in the gospel. And they end up with a figure who's really not much more wise than Socrates or Epictetus or other ethical teachers.
You also have a remark in your book about the new fundamentalism, its literalness, reducing the Bible as well.
That's right. The fundamentalist believed the literal word, every word of the Bible. These people believe the literal word of what they decide is the Bible, which is a very small slice of the actual Bible.
When Jesus went out into the wilderness, when he joined John the Baptist, and in effect went through a kind of desert existence that you likened to that of the Jewish people out in the desert, he also went out with a pretty raggedy and far-out figure. I mean, in some ways, you compare it to like joining a cult today.
That's right. John the Baptist was a kind of crazy man, most people thought. He was.
But it was the beginning of Jesus' ministry.
Yeah, he was attacking people, calling them offspring of snakes, that kind of thing. Jesus must have had a desert experience but like that of the Essenes, and that's why he was celibate as opposed to the normal Jewish requirement of marriage and family. And what is presented under John is probably a whole series of desert experiences that Jesus had informing himself. I presume that's the only way he would have learned Hebrew. People say of him when he does discuss in the temple and elsewhere that he was very learned, and in those days that meant that he knew Hebrew. The ordinary Jew did not, and especially his parents would not. They were poor. The poor were very likely illiterate, and what languages they knew were the Aramaic of their locale and a kind of pidgin Greek that was used to communicate across the whole empire. Jesus obviously underwent some kind of ascetic long experience, which is presented symbolically in the three temptations in the desert. The Gospels often give you an event which is a symbol of a whole development, of a whole series of experiences. The agony in the garden is like that. The temptations in the desert are like that. And probably the baptism by John is like that. It probably shows a long period of serving with John and learning with and from him. Because he was, of course, fully human as well as divine, and he did grow in intelligence, as St. Luke says, just as he grew physically. So he underwent what was obviously a very wrenching experience that helped him step outside the ordinary life and come back into it with this kind of blithe way of walking through all of the barriers and all of the conventions of his time as if there were so many cobwebs.
Those are the three tests you're talking about during what you call the hidden years, or what you generally refer to as the hidden years.
Yeah. And, those were political tests, too. It said, turn stone to bread. You know, you can feed the poor. That was a political program, and he rejected it.
There is a sense of, as you kind of alluded to earlier, Jesus identifying himself with the unclean and the lepers and the immoral people, or those who are regarded as immoral and so forth. And now you allude to a very fringe group, to be sure, but a so-called Christian group or self-identified Christian group that advocates killing fags and all of this kind of dreadful homophobia. Your feeling is pretty evidenced that Jesus would have probably allied himself today with homosexuals.
What you do to the least of these, you do to me. Who are the least now? Often they're gays. So what you do to them, you're doing to Jesus.
But you also say that Jesus, though he was celibate, the notion that he would advocate celibacy is absurd. Why?
Well, it's not absurd, but it's not in the Gospels. The apostles, we certainly know that Peter was married. Probably most or all of them were. And that was the normal thing for a Jew. Paul was not married at the time when he wrote his letters, though many scholars think he had been earlier in his life. And when he says that he would have people follow him in celibacy, he says, I do not have this from the Lord. I'm expressing a preference of my own. Do not take this as a command. He says that over and over in 1 Corinthians. So, the passage that's often used to justify priestly celibacy, priesthood itself is not in the Gospels, is the one where he says some people are born castrated, some people castrate themselves, some people are castrated for the sake of the reign of heaven. And he says, let those who can take that. It's not urging necessarily. And it's like the other outrageous things he says. If your right eye offends you, pull it out. If your right hand offends you, cut it off. In other words, follow your inner religion, your inner purity, and don't pay attention to the externals. It's in line with that. So people say, well, we should be, they don't say you should literally castrate themselves, but you should be celibate. Do they want to have people pulling their eye out or cutting their hand off? It's in that same context.
But you interpret that as being more of an emphasis on the physical, corporal sense of the body to aspire toward higher spiritual truths, no?
That's right. He's saying don't let what the body does be the test of real religion, inner purity. And he does that in a series of very shocking statements. But the celibacy was not the rule in the early church at all for priests or bishops or anybody else. There are no priests in the Gospels, and when in the late epistles, pseudo-Pauline epistles, bishops show up, they're married. So it was not until the 4th century that the idea of going back again to priestly cleanliness, the purity code, the holy code, holiness code of religion, brought itself back into Christianity at a time when Jesus had thrown it out.
You've been, I suppose, in many ways a kind of thorn to many religious and Catholics who follow at least the kinds of traditions that you don't find religious textual support for. Here in this new book, you talk about Pope Benedict XVI, former Cardinal Ratzinger, and the whole view of the unworthiness of treating the Catholic Mass as a meal.
Yes, that's astonishing. The idea that it's a sacrifice, Jesus attacked sacrifice. And there's no place in the New Testament where it's praised except one place, the Epistle to the Hebrews, where it says that Jesus offered the last sacrifice, making sacrifice obsolete. At the meal, at the Last Supper, he says, do this to remember me. He doesn't say anything about a sacrifice. And in fact, Benedict XVI says that the priest should turn his back on the people, that he should consecrate by himself, and things of that sort. At the Last Supper, Jesus did not get up and step over a little railing and turn his back on the people and talk in a language that neither he nor they understood, Latin. It was a meal. And the image of heaven that's used over and over and over in the Gospels and in the Jewish scripture, for that matter, is always a meal, a banquet. I welcome you to the... And he says, I will not drink wine again at the Last Supper until I drink it with you in the reign, in the kingdom. So he's saying, this is a celebration of our final great party, banquet, at the end of time.
We're joined this hour by famed Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and religious writer Gary Wills. His new book is What Jesus Meant. And let me open the phone lines and invite those of you listening to join us with any questions or comments you might have. Pretty radical view here of Jesus when he was upon the earth and what his message was in the Gospels. If you'd like to join us, feel free to do that now. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. That's toll-free wherever you're listening to us or however, radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Join us now at 866-733-6786 or join us by email. Our email address is forum, F-O-R-U-M, at kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Gary Wills, who's Professor of History Emeritus at Northwestern. His books include Papal Sin, Why I'm a Catholic, and the Pulitzer Prize-winning Lincoln at Gettysburg. And his most recent book is What Jesus Meant. And essentially, it's an interpretation of the Gospels done, as he says, not as a scholarly work, but a devotional one. But it sees Jesus as a figure who avoided all political action, really, direct political action, and yet was in pursuit of a program against wealth, against acquisition and acquisitiveness, and against power. Let me go to our callers, and let's go first to Mark in Mountain View. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. I have a bit of a counter view. I've been looking into this with several friends, and there is no historical evidence, reliable historical evidence, that Jesus ever actually existed. The Gospels weren't written until about 70 or 80 A.D. All the other references, extra-biblical, come from the 2nd century and on. And it turns out, if you look into the historical evidence, Jesus seems to be nothing more than a creation of extensive imagination.
Gary Willis.
Yes. Well, the Gospels were written in 70 and 80 and 90, but Paul's epistles were written in the 40s and the 50s. And they got extremely wide circulation and acceptance from not because he was the first one to bring the message, but because in most places he went, there were already Christian communities of people remembering and celebrating the life of Jesus. Paul says that 500 people saw him when he rose, and Paul was among them. So the Gospels are late, you're quite right, but the question is whether they are in accord with the reports that Paul gives, not only from himself. He quotes hymns, pre-existing hymns from before his Gospels.
What about the college?
So there is very early evidence of Jesus and of his impact on vast numbers of people.
Apostolic evidence, but what about the caller's point that there may not be any real historical evidence as such?
Well, what do you mean by history? Paul is recording events that he saw and was part of. That's history. You mean secular history?
Secular history,
well,
if you will.
But I don't necessarily say that nothing exists but what exists in a secular in secular history. Well, and, of course, there are Tacitus and other historians who talk about the followers of Jesus. So Jesus must have been around to have raised a following of some stature and size by the end of the first century.
Let me thank the caller. And I knew I'd probably get this email from Marion in San Francisco. It says, last week, a Presbyterian minister on gays. This week, George Wills on Jesus. Gary Wills on Jesus, it should be. We are surrounded by an ever-tightening noose of religion. I would not have expected to find you in this company, meaning me. With so many pressing topics, so many important people to celebrate, Cesar Chavez, why must we be subjected to these mythological views? Please give us reality, or at least fiction labeled as fiction, but leave religion to the churches. It's curious how sometimes programs cluster. You know, there was one week where we happened to do three programs on architecture. It wasn't necessarily that we were moving in that direction, but there is a kind of general disdain out there that I'm sure you recognize, Gary Wills, for religion and pursuing religious topics.
How odd to bring up Cesar Chavez, because he was certainly a worshiper of Jesus. You know, he's not separate from religion. Religion is an important part of life. To say it's some kind of peripheral thing that you should not even admit into the mainstream of discourse is simply bigotry.
Here's an email from a listener who says, please explain why you believe Jesus was divine or is divine. So many see him as no more than a good man, but he himself said that only God is good. Many see him as being no more than Buddha, Muhammad. In your view, was he in a class by himself?
Well, yes, I think he was in a class by himself. I think, of course, that there are many religions, and they do have some path to God. I happen to think that Jesus is the best path to God, not excluding all of the others. When we're talking about God, we're talking about something that's essentially unknowable and that is revealed in history through certain channels. St. Augustine said, if it's God, you don't understand it. If you understand it, it's not God. So there are certain people who are, in effect, messengers from God. And to say mythology is to say that is a reaching out toward God. It always has been mythology. But there are real elements in mythology, and Jesus seems to me the realist. He has a kind of way of taking one of the greatest revelations of all kind to the Jewish people and exalting that and reforming that and altering that in a very special way, which fulfilled and yet transcended the whole Jewish history, I argue. So it's true, a lot of people just think he's a man. If you think he's a man, you have to get rid of all the disturbing parts of the gospel and cut him down to the size of Socrates, and then probably pay more attention to him than you do to Socrates.
We'll have another listener comparing him to Martin Luther King or Gandhi, someone who...
Well, Martin Luther King certainly was a worshiper of Jesus. You know, it's like saying Cesar Chavez should be put in place of Jesus. They're the people who would least say that.
And we go to more of your calls. Let's go next to Jim. Good morning. You're on Forum.
Yeah, this is Jim?
Yeah. Your gym, I guess, yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear it for sure. Yeah, I wanted to point out that Jesus was also talking about our divinity collectively, all of us individually. He said that ye are gods, and he said God is one.
He
said,
where did he say you are gods?
He's quoting Psalms 82:6 in
where?
John 10:34.
Where?
John 10:34. It's after he had said, I and my Father are one, and the Pharisees got upset at him, wanted to stone him for that. So he said, what is it you condemn me about? And they said, because you identify yourself as God. And he says, is it not written in your law, I have said, ye are gods? And if it's said by he to be a loved God, then can this be
well,
denied?
Well, yeah, that was a polemical answer. They were
okay.
Saying it's automatically...
I go on, and in John 17:21, he says that we are all one with God, and we are all one with one another, as he is one with God.
Yes, through him. I am the vine, you are the branches. Not you are separate branches. You are united to the Father only in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. And our divinity comes from entering into Jesus, being part of his mystical body.
But always goes back to the Father.
Yes.
Yeah. And let me get Robin on here next. Robin, thanks for waiting. You're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Wills, I'm looking forward to reading your book. I haven't done that yet. I have been the pastor of a small inner-city church for about 7 years, and I think I agree with what I understand you to be saying in your book and saying on the program today. And in our small missional inner-city church, we tried to both live the life and teach the life that I think you're describing. And we found two huge obstacles that I guess would be categories to doing this. One was the existing church culture, which I'm a Protestant pastor, the existing church culture, which doesn't seem to give many outlets to what Jesus is really saying in the Bible. And then sort of a personal selfishness that when people read what Jesus is really saying, that we all take a step back and think, well, this isn't what I signed on for, or I don't think I can do this. And I'm wondering what your view is on how people and how congregations can live out what Jesus is really talking to and get away from the false culture of Christianity that's been pervasive for centuries.
Yes, those are two very good points. The first one about the institutional church, and the second one, it's too much an affront to reason. He can't have meant that. That's, of course, the reaction to many, many of his sayings. He just can't have meant that. So we'll skip over that. It's true. He comes to offer a very, very demanding, almost scary challenge to us all. And if you don't think that, if you think you can tame him, you can put him in kind of leading reins and halters, then you are not paying attention to the gospel. It's impossible, probably, to live up to these high demands. I dedicated my last book to Father Dan Berrigan, the Jesuit priest, and I said to Dan Berrigan, a Christian, and he said to me, you left out the all-important adjective, would-be. We're all would-be Christians.
The Berrigans kind of changed you politically, didn't they, in many ways?
Yes, they certainly did. They and Dorothy Day and a number of other people. On the institutional church, he attacked institutional religion. He attacked every form of it that was available for him to attack. And what he said is, where two or three are gathered in my name, I am there with them. And I take that to mean every group of Christians that's truly trying to follow him are all bound together with each other because he's with them all. And the institutional church keeps trying to tell us that that's not the case, that we shouldn't pay attention to those who don't belong to our church. That reminds me of the Gospel of Luke, where Jesus sends out the disciples on their first mission to cast out devils, and they come back, and Apostle John says to him, we saw somebody casting out devils in your name, but he wasn't one of us, so we stopped him. And Jesus says, why did you do that? He was doing it in my name. And that is the great ecumenical statement, it seems to me. Christians who are working in his name should all be part of the vine. The great scandal of Christian religion is Catholics burning heretics, Protestants hanging Jesuits in England, Congregationalists in Massachusetts hanging Quakers, Protestants in Philadelphia burning convents. Where in the gospel do you find that that's how you're supposed to treat other people who are gathered in his name? The institutional church does protect itself more than it pays attention to the gospels. And that's probably always going to be the case. And the only thing we can do is try to act as a leaven within all of the institutional churches, all of us who are gathered in his name, even if there are only two or three of us at times.
Recommended reading here being Dostoevsky's Grand Inquisitor, which I think you mentioned at least on a couple of occasions.
That's right.
What about our president and his notion of what Jesus meant? When he was asked what philosopher influenced him the most, he said Jesus, and he's on a number of occasions certainly invoked the name of Jesus. This is not the Jesus I think that you are giving us a picture of, or is it?
Well, first of all, he was not a philosopher. He was God, and he didn't bring a political program. The Bush administration claims to be having a faith-based politics. There is no faith-based politics that's part of Jesus' mission. If it is a politics, it's not his. He said, my followers would fight for me if I had a reign that they could support. When they brought him the coin that had the divine Caesar on it, and they said, what do we do with this? Do we pay our taxes? And he said, give to Caesar what's Caesar, and to God what is God's. He separated church and state, separated religion and politics. To say that you have a kind of faith-based war is a terrible affront to the Jesus that preached peace. It's interesting that he says he follows Jesus, and yet as governor of Texas, he executed many, many people. And there's only one time that capital punishment comes up in the Gospels. They bring him, the Gospel of John, they bring him a woman who was convicted under the law of adultery, and the law says she should be stoned to death. And they say to him, what should we do? And he said, if any of you have never sinned, then pick up the first stone. And they all walk away. None of them can claim that they've never sinned. Apparently, George Bush can claim that he never sinned because he went ahead and executed.
Kelly, join us. You're on. Good morning.
Hey, thank you, Michael. Good job. That's pretty brave of you to go ahead and pick one up. Good job. I wanted to talk to your guest. One thing I noticed that I really like about Jesus is that he talks about being religious. And I think Jesus' definition of religion is to comfort the orphan and the widow. Not necessarily, well, I think that was the bottom line. I wish I was religious. I'd like to comfort. I don't even know an orphan. I know very few widows that I would comfort. Anyways, the other point was go sin no more. That seemed like kind of the bottom line of all of us sinners, that when Jesus, you know, said by faith you've been saved, just go sin no more and move along. I thought that was good.
That's right. He says that precisely to the convicted woman. He says, is none of these people going to execute you? And she says, no, apparently. He said, neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. He says that to a criminal, a convicted criminal. And, of course, it was a convicted criminal hanging beside him on the cross to whom he said, this day you will be with me in paradise.
I also like the thing, the choice issue. Every day I got to get up and it's my will versus his will. And I always find that to be the struggle. I know that's a struggle for, I think, for all individuals. What are we going to do today? You know, I got to get in here, got to get to work. My will versus God's will. And that always seems to be a wonderful friction or tension. I often think about whose will am I doing today, even moment by moment. I think it's great.
Okay, thank you for that. Thy will be done, whomever thy may be. There's also the phrase that keeps coming back to me about feed my sheep. you know, there was a sense of real altruism in the Gospels, of love, of helping the poor and the dispossessed and the oppressed. And I mean, that's the radical interpretation that you're presenting, isn't it?
Well, that's all that's in the Gospel. It's love is the whole thing, you know, and what he says is, I have brought you a new commandment, love one another as I have loved you.
But that's not a, I mean, the passage, for example, the controversial passage of putting the daughter against the mother and the son against, that's not a message of love or peace, is it?
Well, again, this is that kind of eschatological, abrupt, immense demands that he can make and we can't. If I came up to you and said, hate your father, if you don't hate your father more than you love me, then you're not worthy of me. You'd say, I'm a nut. I'm selfish and crazy. Only Jesus can say that. And he says it to emphasize the supreme exigency of going to the Father through him.
We'll go to more of your calls. Matthew, thank you for waiting. Good morning.
Hello, gentlemen. Thanks for your talk about compassion. I think it's really important in this world. So I have two kind of related questions. First of all, since making it to God is only through Jesus, are you saying that a Buddhist can't achieve godhood or something like that? And secondly, what do you think about Opus Dei? Because it seems to me they don't preach and follow compassion. And since they have so much power, it's kind of scary that that's happening. And thanks. I'll take my call off the air.
All right. We thank you for the call.
Well, as I said earlier, I think God reaches out toward us and we reach out toward God in many ways. And the early church, especially the Orthodox Church, felt that Jesus went back and saved the people who had believed in other images of God. He validated them. That's what's meant by he descended into hell. He opened up hell and went and brought out the captives of the past, all of them. We don't pay much attention to that, although it's in the creed. But the Eastern Church has always paid a great deal of attention to that and thought that that's the real point of Jesus. The anacatastasis, they're going down and bringing up the dead, is their resurrection story, celebrated in many, many of their great works of art. So, no, I don't at all exclude other religious insights.
Here's a listener named John who says, Mr. Wills is on record as asserting Christian identity is rightly linked to the creeds we have received from church councils, and Mr. Wills also is on record noticing that Jesus' message promotes a non-hierarchical model for Christians. Yet the creeds themselves were set by bishops, archbishops, and politicians who used their power, called in favors, and acted in a strong hierarchical way to keep a particular set of beliefs in the creeds and exclude other beliefs as heresy. In other words, diversity of belief which existed in the early church was destroyed by the creeds, seemingly the very thing which Mr. Wills finds troubling about hierarchy. Why, then, should Christian identity be linked as closely to the beliefs recognized in the creeds as Mr. Wills suggests?
Well, let's go back. The creeds were formed by Christian communities coming together to decide on the core of their beliefs. And it's true that by that time there were bishops. The bishops, however, were elected by the people in those days. And at the councils, these bishops elected by the people voted in a democratic way. Hundreds of bishops voted at the councils. There's a wonderful new book out on this, and it shows that this was a Christian community speaking for and with their followers, and not instituting from above, but saying, what is the sense of your community through for all of these bishops? You know, it's interesting. Pope Benedict XVI, when he was still Cardinal Ratzinger, said, belief is not set by majority vote. Well, it was. At the Council of Nicaea, there was a majority vote, and there was a minority vote, and the majority won. It was not a question of a pope or a certain set of elite cardinals or, bishops or archbishops or patriarchs setting the belief. And most of these bishops were fairly humble and from very fairly humble communities. You know, there were hundreds of bishops in Africa alone. So it was not at all the hierarchical church that we have a picture of these days. That did not arise until the Middle Ages, and it arose on a monarchical model. at a time when, in the Middle Ages, monarchy seemed the only form of legitimate authority for all Western communities. And so the church fathers, leaders, imitated that. But that's not how the creed and the councils were formed.
Talking with Gary Wills, eminent historian and author of many books on religion. His newest book, What Jesus Meant, James Carroll, the author of Constantine's Sword, says, faithful to the heart of tradition, yet entirely original, Gary Wills' meditation cuts through cant, piety, and political exploitation to bring Jesus alive in his urgent significance. And Peter Gomes, who has been a guest on this program a couple of times, as has James Carroll, actually, who is professor of morals at Harvard and the minister in the Memorial Church there, says, with characteristic clarity, Gary Wills gets to the heart of the gospel and, through a critical reading of what Jesus says in the gospel, surprises and provokes all of us who claim to know what Jesus meant. Let me go to find out what more of our listeners want to say here. And Lisa, you're up. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Wills. Thank you for taking my call. What I don't understand is why Mary, knowing the conception of Jesus, why she and her and his family would have thought of Matt.
Well, because he broke all of the expectations that they had of him. It doesn't say, by the way, that his mother thought him mad. It says just his family, whatever that means. It doesn't mean every member of the family. But Mary was dumbfounded by him over and over. It says that. When it's said you'll be the Holy Spirit will overshadow you and you will bring forth a son, she says, the gospel says that she was dumbfounded. And when she finds him in the temple, it says, and he says, why did you look for me? Don't you know I'd be at my father's? It says she didn't understand that. And the same thing when Simeon speaks to her in the presentation in the temple, it says she didn't understand. Nobody understood him because he didn't fit their expectations. In fact, Luke says that she put these things in her heart and sifted them. She struggled to understand, as mothers of brilliant or unconventional children always do. And that's why I think whenever I say the rosary, which is every day, I pray to Mary to help me understand, as she struggled very hard to understand him.
Let me thank Lisa for her call, and we'll go to another caller from Los Altos. Good morning.
Hi. Yeah, I'm calling. Thanks, Michael, for all the wonderful shows you put on.
Thank you for that.
I was putting a little plug. My brother-in-law was a minister at the Riverside Church in New York City, and about 3 years ago he wrote a book, also coincidentally called What Jesus Meant, the Beatitudes and Meaningful Life. So I guess two things. One is I was curious if Gary ever had an opportunity to see it or read it. If not, I just want to highly recommend it. It's by Westminster Press, and it's got a forward by William Sloan Coffin in the blurb on the back by Roger Rosenblatt.
Do you know the book?
Yes, I didn't know about that book when I titled mine, but he graciously sent me a copy of it, and we've corresponded, and it's a wonderful book, and I think people should read it.
Let me thank the caller and go to Billy. Good morning.
Good morning. I was wondering if you're familiar with the book by Keith Akers, The Lost Religion of Jesus, Simple Living and Nonviolence in Early Christianity. As someone raised as a Protestant in the Bible Belt and as a hunter who later became vegetarian, I was taken aback a few years ago when I heard Mr. Akers speaking, making the case, as he does in his book, which I bought at that lecture, of Jesus as having been vegetarian, perhaps even vegan, for ethical reasons, and that was actually the reason he drove the money changers out of the temple, was that the money changers were there in order for people who came from out of the area to exchange their foreign currencies for the local one so they could buy sacrificial animals for sacrifice, and that it was actually more of an animal rights motivation than an anti-economics motivation. Are you familiar with his work?
No, but it sounds very admirable. But I must say, Jesus was against sacrifice. He expressly said that, and some of the Jewish prophets were against sacrifice, and he quotes them. But that's not the same thing as saying that he was against ordinary eating of meat. We don't know. There's nothing about that. What he was attacking was the idea that you placate an angry God by a sacrifice. And the reason he drove out the money the changers of money. Why did they change money? It's because when people brought in a denarius, a Roman coin, which with the picture of the divine Augustus on it, that was unclean. It could not go into the temple, and so it had to be changed for shekels, for coins that were not, that were clean, that you could take into the temple. And what he was attacking here and many places was the cleanliness code. He broke that in many ways. He did not do the ritual ablutions, and he was attacked for that. So it's a kind of beside the point to say that eating meat was the what he was up to there.
The book again, What Jesus Meant, the author Gary Wills. Always good to have you on, Gary Wills. Thank you so much for being with us this hour of Forum.
It's a pleasure.
And another hour coming your way. We do lots of different kinds of programs here, just to reassure you on that. In fact, we're going to be talking about noise, pop, and music, and you're going to hear some sounds in the hour coming up. Also, April 2006 marks the centennial anniversary of the 1906 California earthquake and fire, and Forum is going to produce a two-hour live program assessing the science and seismic hazards of earthquakes and examining how a similar disaster may have impact on the economy as well as the culture and lives of Californians. And additionally, we'll discuss how cities and social services are addressing weaknesses and strengths and ultimately assess how the state's preparing for the possibility of the next big one. It's a special two-hour broadcast with from the Lawrence Hall of Science in Berkeley. And if you want to participate in that audience, give us a call, excuse me, at 415-553-2119. Again, that's 415-553-2119. I want to thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mall, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory. Thank our engineer, Danny Bringer, and thanks to all of you for listening to Forum, for being a part of Forum, calling, emailing, and being with us each day, Monday through Friday, 9 to 11 in the morning. You can also let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or calling our listener call-in line at 415-553-3300. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.